Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Garrett Vogesser. I'm the National Director of Tribal Partnerships for the National Wildlife Federation. I'd like to welcome you to the call today, where we're going to be talking about the release of our report, Honoring the River, how hard rock mining impacts tribal communities, as well as have guest speakers from a number of tribes to explain the impacts of hard rock mining to their communities. Honoring the River describes the impacts of mining on tribal communities and draws attention to two loopholes in the Clean Water Act's regulations that allow mines to treat our waters as industrial waste dumps. We produced this report because mines are often in remote areas and thus often get little attention. Unfortunately, that is why mining companies can get away with the negative impacts of their mining operations to the environment. For more than a century, American Indian tribes and Alaska Natives have borne many of the burdens of hard rock mining and a few of the benefits. Today, even as tribes continue to suffer from poisoned rivers, contaminated sacred sites, and other devastation caused by old and abandoned mines, they face a new round of threats. Mines are being proposed from Alaska's Bristol Bay, a watershed that supports the greatest remaining runs of wild sockeye salmon on Earth, to the Great Lakes Basin, which contains 84% of North America's supply of fresh surface water, to proposed mines in Montana and Arizona. With that introduction, I would like to mention that we will hold all questions until the end of all of our introductory comments. The speakers today, besides myself, are Mike Wiggins, chairman of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Tribe of Chippewa Indians, Rich Jansen, head of the Department of Natural Resources of the Confederated Salish and Kootenai Tribes, Chuck Brumliff, an environmental specialist with the Keweenaw Bay Indian Community, Jim Vogel, an attorney with the Fort Belknap Indian Community, and Tony Torini, senior attorney for the National Wildlife Federation. With that, I would like to introduce our first speaker. Our first speaker is Chairman Mike Wiggins of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Tribe of Chippewa Indians, whose land is threatened by the Gogebic Taconite proposed open ore pit mine. With that, I would like to hand it over to Chairman Wiggins.
Thanks, sir. In Bad River, we're facing an imminent threat to the health and welfare of our tribe, our homeland, and its people from a mining company that essentially plans to obliterate the headwaters of our watershed and our home. The Bad River watershed is recognized as a state, national, international wetland of importance. It contains pristine wild rice beds, critical spawning areas for sturgeon and walleye and everything else. And the mining threat that's proposed by GTAC and the mining company threatens our surface waters, our groundwater recharge station and the accompanying aquifers underneath our homeland, and the overall air quality of the Bad River Reservation. For us, everything is at stake here. The proposed project that's been discussed is an open pit that is 4 miles long and up to 1,200 feet deep. And it's essentially mountaintop removal that stands to create over 400 million cubic yards of waste rock in what is essentially a water-rich environment. That waste rock will contain sulfuric acid producing capability. When we look at Wisconsin state law, it's been rewritten by the mining company, and the integrity of the permitting process at that level has been diminished through shortened time frames and reduced scrutiny of permitting responsibilities that are on the mining company. All of that has been called this notion of creating certainty for a mining company in a permitting process. With that being said, the federal side of permitting and the loopholes that are there through the Clean Water Act are magnified in terms of the critical need to close these loopholes, and are magnified through the filter of putting integrity back into a mining company permit process. Essentially, when everything's at stake for tribal homelands, for small communities, for the sustainability of communities and regions, we need these types of permits and these types of catastrophic projects and the damage they do to the environment to be thoroughly vetted for what they truly are. And some of those loopholes related to how we treat wastewater treatment systems and to how we classify fill speak directly to the challenges that we face. If waste rock in the form of 400 plus million cubic yards have the potential to produce sulfuric acid, we should not be classifying them as benign fill, because that's what is there as a portal for a mining company to try and get their permits through. We should be classifying that stuff as sulfuric acid and denying that because of the detrimental impacts onto communities, onto sovereign nations, and ultimately onto the water resources that all of our people and all of these ecosystems depend on. Water is life, and that's what is really at stake and what we're fighting for in terms of our future here in Bad River as a sovereign nation, as a people, and ultimately for the future of our ecosystem and our surrounding area here on the shores of Lake Superior.
Thank you, Chairman Wiggins. This is Garrett Bogesser once again. Next, I would like to pass it to Rich Jansen, head of the Department of Natural Resources at the Confederated Salish and Kootenai Tribes in northern Montana. These tribes' lands are still affected by 100-year-old mining operations, and the tribes are now fighting two proposed silver mines. With that, I would like to pass it over to Rich Jansen.
Okay, thank you. Again, my name is Rich Jansen. I'm a tribal member of the Salish and Kootenai Tribes. I've lived here in western Montana my entire life. And in working for the tribes for the last 20 years after I went to school at the University of Montana and then got my master's in business at Gonzaga University. But mining compacts are not a new item for our tribe or other Indian tribes. In 1998, the Atlantic Richfield Company, or ARCO, agreed as part of a legal settlement to pay our tribe $18.3 million to restore, replace, and or acquire the equivalent of tribal treaty protected resources of the upper Clark Fork River Basin that were injured by the release of hazardous substances. These dollars have been used for planning and implementation of a wetland and riparian habitat restoration plan and a bull trout restoration plan, using a holistic approach to the natural resource management of these sites. We looked at the entire Flathead Reservation, but we have been targeting what we call the Jocko Watershed for mitigation of lands and bull trout. Plan and mitigation work is currently ongoing with final restoration activities scheduled for completion by 2020. Now we are again facing threats to our resources from large hard rock mines. Foreign corporations are proposing to expand and or develop the Montanore and Rock Creek mines adjacent to and underneath the Cabinet Mountain Wilderness Area. These mines are located in our Aboriginal territory of the Salish and Kootenai tribes. These mining activities are a short distance from our reservation, which may impact significant religious sites and threaten water, fisheries, and other uses in the region. Further, these mines threaten our long-standing efforts to restore the endangered bull trout, as well as our interest in preserving important cultural areas. Montanore and Rock Creek mines would be the two of the largest underground copper and silver mines in North America. Montanore mine would involve extensive dewatering due to underground excavation, depleting the groundwater in the region, and potentially decimating bull trout populations. The impacts of dewatering would be particularly severe along the East Fork of the Bull River, the most productive bull trout fishery in the lower Clark Fork River, bull trout recovery area. Mine would also involve the construction of a massive tailing reservoir in the upper Kootenai River watershed capable of containing 120 million tons of mining waste in perpetuity. Tailings and other waste would be dumped on top of the streams, wetlands, and springs located within the impoundment, destroying those waters and threatening the ground and surface waters lower in the watershed. With that said, I am complete with my comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Rich. Now I'd like to pass it to Chuck Brimlew, an environmental specialist with Keweenaw Bay Indian Community, which has been affected by Rio Tinto's Eagle Mine's nickel and copper mining operation. Chuck, I'd pass it to you.
Well, thank you. First, I'd like to introduce kind of our setting. The Keweenaw Bay is formed by the Keweenaw Peninsula, which extends out into Lake Superior about 50 miles, and the bay is between the peninsula and the mainland. The peninsula started copper mining in 1844, and during the next 150 years, mine tailings were dumped into area waterways wherever waterways were close to the mines. The result of this is that the area is considered the largest Superfund site in the United States. We have miles and miles of tailings along our waterways internal to the peninsula, as well as along the shores of Lake Superior. One of the bright spots in the Ojibwe treaties of 1837, 1842, and 1854 are the rights for the tribes to hunt, fish, and gather within the lands that they ceded to the U.S. government. But our primary concern now is that these rights become pretty useless if the environment is impacted and the fish and flora and fauna that are hunted and gathered are impacted by the environment. An example of that is the mercury that is now found in fish from Lake Superior, where we have fish advisories due to mercury and other metals. This affects all children, pregnant women, and consumers. And in a tribal setting, the tribal members eat more fish than the average American, and so end up with this bioaccumulating metal in their food supply. We now have a very proactive mining state and also a resurgence of mining in Michigan. The state agencies appear to bend over backwards to coach and advise mining companies on how to navigate our regulations most effectively. Michigan, I'll just mention as a sideline, is the only mining state with no federal permits required to permit a mine. It is all up to the state of Michigan. Both permitted mines in Michigan now take advantage of the Clean Water Act loopholes that are the subject of this report. The first one, the Rio Tinto Eagle Mine, the tailings are being dumped directly into a lake, several million tons of mine tailings. The second mine, the Orvana Copperwood Mine, will fill or destroy some 14,000 feet of streams and fill over 50 acres of wetlands. They're located very close to the shores of Lake Superior and plan to create a huge tailings pump, a tailings dump, a very fine ground metalliferous rock. The state only requires 5 years of follow-up water treatment, and yet we know from experience that acid mine drainage frequently doesn't even start for 50 years. This creates a source of contaminants to Lake Superior for generations to come. We also notice that the two largest potential violators of the Clean Water Act have exemptions, along with mining this, of course, is the oil and gas industry. And we really are serious about attempting to close these Clean Water Act loopholes that have been created for the mining industry and an attempt to not recreate the mining disasters we've had in the past. And that terminates my comment.
Thanks, Chuck. Next, we have Jim Vogel. He's an attorney with the Fort Belknap Indian Community in Montana, which is affected by the Zortman-Lambeski gold mine. Jim, I'll pass it to you.
Thank you, Garrett. I represent the Fort Belknap Indian Community Council of the Fort Belknap Reservation. The reservation has two tribes, is home to two tribes, the Gros Ventre and Assiniboine. The lands that are impacted by this mining, the reservation lands, these are located in north-central Montana. The reservation's about 720,000 acres. If you looked at a map of Montana and saw the Fort Belknap Indian Reservation, you'd see the reservation on the southern end. There's a notch that has been carved out of the reservation, and that involves lands that were taken by the United States, purportedly valueless, but for the purpose of fostering mining back in the 1880s. That mining went on for decades and then dropped off with the easily available placer mining, other gold that was available, being depleted. And then in the late 70s, the area of Dortmund and Landesky were again developed, this time with heap leach cyanide mining, where basically you had entire mountain blown up and loaded onto huge pads with millions of gallons of cyanide poured over the top, leaching gold and silver out of them into a collection system, and then basically being piped to holding ponds. As these mines were operating, the Bureau of Land Management conducted local hearings, and many people, including the tribes, strongly opposed these activities, primarily because of the ongoing practice of dumping millions of gallons of cyanide and then uncovering in the mining process large areas of sulfide ore, which produces sulfuric acid. In the process, the tribe repeatedly requested that an EIS, Environmental Impact Statement, be done. Bureau of Land Management concluded that, no, that wasn't necessary. You had no baseline information developed as to what the impacts were having. And then eventually, the mine went out of business because gold dropped. In the 1990s, when gold prices dropped below what they thought was profitable, they shut down and left these circumstances there for tribes and state of Montana and the federal government to deal with. These mines and these pollutants were within 2 miles of two reservation communities. These areas were surrounded on three sides by reservation land. There's ongoing problems with the water quality. There's been adverse impact to cultural sites. There's been adverse impact to water quantity in the area. Wildlife has been viewed to be in drastically reduced numbers. The fisheries that some people utilized in the area have been depleted. All of this without adequate funds for remediation. You now have a perpetual water treatment problem in the area that, because the mining companies went bankrupt, is now being funded by taxpayer dollars and on-reservation activities to try to minimize the impacts on both surface and groundwater. The council at Fort Belknap has supported the release of this report from the National Wildlife Federation honoring the river. While mining activities in the Little Rockies in the Island Mountains at Fort Belknap have now stopped, future generations will be suffering these problems, all because of the refusal to recognize what everyone saw as common sense, that these activities and the impact on water and lives was going to be for forever. And, so the council at this point supports efforts to prevent these kinds of activities in the future and hopes that some remediation will help the circumstances that Fort Belknap. Thank you.
Thanks, Jim. And next, I'd like to turn it over to our final speaker, is Tony Tarini, Senior Attorney for the National Wildlife Federation. Tony?
Thanks, Garrett. I'm calling from Anchorage, where it's still 9:50, so good morning, everybody. High metals prices and advanced technologies are driving a mining boom in this country. There's no question that we need many of the materials that mining provides, but there's also no denying that mining is one of the most environmentally harmful industries in the nation. Modern mines involve the destruction of many thousands of acres of land and the use of large quantities of toxic chemicals such as cyanide. According to EPA's most recent toxic release inventory, the metals mining industry released 1.9 billion tons of toxic chemicals in 2011, making it far and away the largest source of toxic pollution in the country. Hard rock mining also has a well-documented record of polluting surface and groundwater. EPA estimates that more than 40% of the headwaters in western watersheds have already been contaminated by mining. There are over 100 mines listed on EPA's list of Superfund sites. Long-term water treatment is usually the most significant cost associated with mine cleanup. Developing new mines is a complex business, but there are certain practices that clearly violate sound public policy. Mines should never be allowed to discharge untreated tailings and other waste into the waters that sustain our fish, wildlife, and communities. Unfortunately, two loopholes have evolved in the regulations implementing the Clean Water Act that allow mines to treat the nearest river valley or wetland as an industrial waste dump. The first loophole is found in EPA and Army Corps of Engineers regulations, which state that waste treatment systems are not waters of the United States and therefore not protected by the Clean Water Act. These regulations allow mining companies to impound wetlands and streams, call the impoundment a waste treatment system, and then discharge tailings and other waste into these non-waters without a Clean Water Act permit. Originally, this loophole was limited to man-made waters, but was expanded to include natural waters in the early 1990s. The second loophole is the result of a 2002 regulatory change in the definition of fill material. Under the current definition, EPA and the Corps can treat the discharge of mine waste as fill material subject to Section 404, a program intended to govern dredging and construction-related activities rather than to regulate industrial waste. As a result, discharges of mining waste into waters can avoid being subjected to the strict pollution standards adopted by EPA decades ago for the mining industry. As you've heard from the other speakers today, tribes have been disproportionately impacted by mining pollution and the Clean Water Act loopholes. National Wildlife Federation is calling on the Obama administration to make the straightforward regulatory changes needed to close these loopholes and to protect all of our communities from the chemicals, heavy metals, and acid drainage produced by modern mines. Thank you, and over to you, Garrett.
Thank you, Tony. At this time, we're going to open it up for questions.
Thank you. To ask a question, press 0 followed by a 1 on your touch-tone phone. Questions will be answered in the order they are received. If you have a question, press 0 followed by a 1 now, and please hold for a moment as our system compiles your responses.
This is Garrett Vogesser with National Wildlife Federation. Again, as we're waiting for questions, I wanted to give you a little bit of information. First, if you would like to speak further with NWF or any of our speakers on this call today, please contact Lacey McCormick. Her phone number is 512-610-7765, and her email is McCormick, McCormick, at nwf.org. And one other point, that the full report can be found online at www.nws.org/honoring the river.
And we have a question from Mike Simonson of Wisconsin Public Radio. Please go ahead.
Thanks. Good afternoon, everybody, except Anchorage. Good morning.
Okay.
Chuck Brimla, how do you spell your last name, please?
B-R-U-M-L-E. V-E.
Have you folks actually approached the Obama administration yet? And if so, have you gotten a reply?
We have not. Our president has gone to Washington a couple times. Chris Schwartz, council president, has been to Washington to make statements and meet with some of the meetings that the tribes have been invited to. But outside of that, we have not. You may have noticed in my brief statement that the state of Michigan holds all of the permitting authority in the state of Michigan. So ours is mostly a state-level effort. We do try to drag the EPA into our comments and our problems with the mining industry here in Michigan, but they are not in the direct line of fire because they do not have any permitting authority here in the state.
This is Garrett Vogesser with National Wildlife Federation. I don't know, Tony Tarini, if you would like to add anything to a response to that question.
Sure. As Chuck indicated, because Michigan has assumed the Section 404 and 402 programs, Clean Water Act issues are largely a state issue. However, if EPA and the Corps were to close the mining loophole, part of the condition upon which for state assumption is that their programs be at least as rigorous as the federal program. So our expectation is that if the federal government takes action, the state of Michigan will have to as well, and will resolve some of the problems that Chuck outlined.
If I could follow up with Chairman Wiggins. Hello, Chairman.
Hello, sir.
Say, do you think that the now that the state has its regulations and you're hoping for relief from the federal government, is this going to hurt if the EPA and Army Corps have these loopholes? Is it going to make it easier to get an iron ore mine in Gigebic?
Well, absolutely. When you look at the amount of toxic waste rock that's going to be created, along with the water-rich area that they're going to try and mine in, they're going to depend on these loopholes, really, to unleash what is essentially going to be a shell game of trying to say this stuff is safe, and it's not.
If I could ask one more question, is this the beginning of a united front of tribes and conservation groups working together?
Mike, I think if you're asking me, I think it's the beginning of communities trying to protect themselves. If there's some type of commonality, it's the fact that extractive industry is swooping down, exploiting resources, and leaving a legacy of toxicity that's hurting people, communities, and ecosystems into perpetuity, long after the 10 to 15 years of so-called manna from heaven is gone. And so there's commonality, but I think it's humans essentially fighting for what are inherently basic human rights, and that is access to clean drinking water, access to clean air, and the hope that our babies will have the same.
And this is Garrett Vogesser with the National Wildlife Federation. I'd just like to add on that, you know, as we looked at producing this report and the efforts of NWF, having worked with tribes and various issue conservations over the last 20 years, we knew we have shared values with tribes, and that's protecting wildlife and habitat, as well as preserving cultural resources. And so we approach all our partnerships with tribes on that level. And as we looked at doing this report, we realized that NWF can't do this alone, and none of us can do this alone. And that's why we reached out to Bad River and all these other folks on the call, as well as many others, to get their input into this report and to, you know, in some small way help tell their stories about how they've had to deal with these mining impacts. And we hope that this leads to additional partnerships together to compel EPA and Army Corps of Engineers to close these loopholes.
Thank you. And to ask a question, press 0 followed by a 1 now. And our next question comes from Amy Cree Dunn of Northern Michigan University. Please go ahead.
Hi, yes, my name is Amy Cree Dunn, Northern Michigan University Center for Native American Studies and the North Country Green Party. The fellow who spoke last from the National Wildlife Federation when the panelists were giving their talks there, he's mentioned that he said, there's no question that some of this mining is essential for our survival. As this mining is threatening the very survival of those of us who live in these areas where it's being mined, as this type of mining is threatening the survival of indigenous peoples around the planet, as well as the survival of all our relations, I would like the tribe's response to his comment on that, if that'd be possible.
This is Chuck Brumlev, Keweenaw Bay, and Amy, I will say that we view this, quote, necessity of mining as being driven by a very strong marketing industry and the creation, artificial creation, of this demand for the mining metals. In other words, this is somewhat contrived, and it is all due to our consumer industry that pushes consumption of these metals and does not follow up with responsible, say, recycling or reuse. So there is a bit of a flaw in the mining industry's argument that we all need these metals. Thank you.
And from Bad River's perspective, when we look at the proposed project in the Pinoki Mountains, you know, first of all, with it threatening our groundwater, our surface water, and air quality, there's that, you know, raises imminent threat and very difficult scenarios for us. But from a worldwide perspective, there is no national security interest at stake here. This is environmental profiteering by a particular company that rewrote state mining law for itself, and really that wrote into the state law 40% of the net proceeds going back to a quasi-governmental slash private economic development engine that, you know, the state leadership has created and is struggling to administrate. When we look at where you follow the money trail, it goes right back to the mining company and the legislators that voted for the project. When you look at the rationale to essentially destroy one of the most critical wetlands on Lake Superior, this does not serve those national outcomes or worldwide outcomes that are typically thought of as being critical to everyone's survival.
Thank you. And to ask a question, press 0 followed by a 1 now. And it appears that we have no further questions at this time. I would like to turn the call back over to Mr. Bogesser.
Tony, I want to pass it to you for a comment regarding wild rice and a question to the panel to speak to that issue.
Sure. I had been struck preparing this report at the value of wild rice and other cultural resources and the impact of mining on those resources. Up here in Alaska where I live, you know, salmon tends to be the symbol of the negative consequences of hard rock mining, and I've come to realize that, you know, in places like the Midwest, wild rice sort of plays that role. And I was wondering whether any of the speakers would be able to talk a little bit about wild rice and some of the other cultural resources that are impacted by mining.
Well, again, this is Mike Wiggins from Bad River. One of the things that is put forth by our elders in our community is the fact that, well, first of all, the threat is manifests itself against wild rice from mining in a form of sulfate pollution. And we looked to Minnesota to see wild rice dead zones along the St. Louis River and other downstream areas from iron mining projects, taconite mining projects. But what our elders put forth is the fact that plant, you know, that food that grows on the water is an integral part of our migration story, which is essentially the origin of our people coming to find this particular place here in the Great Lakes region. That wild rice was a prophesized food slash plant that would be known to us because it was described as food that grows on the water, and that when we found that plant, essentially we were home. And when you look at the Ojibwe, the Chippewa homeland areas on a map, you'll see the proliferation of ancestral wild rice beds. And for the ones that are still alive and thriving, like here in Bad River, we're digging in and it's all hands on deck to try and protect and preserve and pass on what we have. So those are some of my thoughts.
And I'm sorry, we do have another question in the queue. And that question comes from Mike Simonson of Wisconsin Public Radio. Please go ahead.
I'm sorry, we've shifted gears to wild rice, but I had one more question about what does Obama have to do? I mean, are we talking about legislation needed, or are we talking about executive orders, or what can he do?
Tony Trini, if you could address that question, that would be helpful.
Sure, Mike. You know, this is closing the loopholes is a really good opportunity for the administration because it doesn't require an act of Congress, which, of course, would be very difficult right now. All that is needed to close the loopholes is for EPA and the Corps to make pretty simple changes to regulations that are already on the books. The administration has made a strong commitment to clean water. It's made a strong public commitment to environmental justice. This is something it can and really should be able to do pretty easily.
So it's just a matter of changing current regulations by the agency?
Correct.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you, and we have no further questions at this time.
Well, this is Garrett Voges with the National Wildlife Federation again. I would like to thank all of you who have attended this call to hear from all the tribes about the impacts of hard rock mining to their communities, as well as what can be done to close the mining loopholes to minimize and stop the impacts of hard rock mining to tribal communities and communities across this nation. One last thing I would like to mention again is that if you would like to get in touch with any of the speakers, please contact Lacey McCormick at 512-610-7765 or McCormick, McCormick, at nwf.org. And once again, the report is available online at www.nwf.org/honoring the river. So we thank you for your participation today, and we look forward to speaking with you further as you explore developing stories on this issue. Thank you very much.
Thank you all for your attention. This concludes today's conference call. All listeners may now disconnect.